Hello and welcome to the Learning College. My name is Alex Linder, and you can find this and everything we record at vnnforum.com, also at pyville.net and kirksvilletoday.com. Today we're going to do chapter three, or half of it, of George Lincoln Rockwell's White Power. This is a very long chapter. It's like 28 pages, and I found that in practice, since my recording equipment is limited to 2 hours, anything more than 10 pages an hour, I have to rush a little bit, which I really don't like. So I'm going to go far fast as I can while including everything essential. But I'm going to guess we'll probably get about just about exactly halfway through. There's probably not any natural split in it. I just very briefly glanced it over, but we'll do about halfway most likely. Now, again, we've done chapter one and chapter two, in which Rockwell has outlined by showing the symptoms of American decline. And all of this, as I never tire of saying, in the time before 1970, in the later 60s, this was his last book. It came in 1967, the year he was assassinated, in White Power. And he is talking about spiritual syphilis in chapter two, and using the example of a messed up young man and showing how he became one of his most effective workers, even though the kid had tried everything, and drugs and alcohol and sex and the rest of it, by the time he was 17, and was already jaded on life until he found National Socialism and George Lincoln Rockwell, and he became a great worker for them. That's what we heard about last chapter. But now we'll forge ahead into chapter three, which is called The Chart Forgers. The Chart Forgers. This is about page 23 out of 272 on the PDF I'm using online, which you can find easily. Just use a search engine you can find if you want to follow along. So chapter one, death rattle. Chapter two, spiritual syphilis. A pretty brief chapter. And then chapter three, the chart forgers, which is about 28 pages and considerably longer than the first two. White Power, George Lincoln Rockwell, chapter three, the chart forgers, F-O-R-G-E-R-S. The affairs of a great nation are often described as the ship of state. It's an apt analogy. Remember, Rockwell was in the Navy and had a whole career there, essentially. He was basically cashiered shortly before his 20-year, probably affecting his pension, and probably done for that and political reasons. A nation has a captain, officers, crew, and navigator who must sail it through endless storms, rocks, shoals, and dangers to stay afloat. In a so-called free country, the people are the navigators. You, the citizen, are supposed to steer the American ship of state. You are supposed to elect a captain who does what you want done. Above all, you are supposed to set the policies of the state by majority rule. And to do the steering of the American ship of state, you need charts. No matter how wise he may be, the navigator of a great ship cannot steer the vessel safely through rocks and the dangers without accurate charts. And you cannot make wise decisions on the policies for the American ship of state without accurate facts and information, the quote, charts of dangers surrounding America. Again, title of the chapter, The Chart Forger. So he's talking about how much you need a chart. A shipping chart will show you the folds, the shallows, the narrows, where you're supposed to go and where you better not go and why you better not go there. An extended analogy, this chapter. You cannot make wise decisions on the policies for the American ship of state without accurate facts and information, the, quote, charts of dangers surrounding America. Can there be any doubt about what would happen if somebody managed to give the navigator of a ship phony charts, charts showing rocks where the channel really was, and showing a clear channel where the jagged rocks lurked to rip out the ship's bottom? And whose fault would it be if a ship piled up on the rocks because the navigator had been given falsified charts? The navigator's? Of course not. The fault would be entirely that of whomever forged the charts and sneaked them over on the Honest Navigator. The Navigator would think, however, that he must have done something terribly wrong, because who would imagine that anyone would be low and vile enough to substitute forged charts? The thought would never even occur to most honest navigators. That's just what's happening to America. That's why we keep piling up the rocks of communism, crime, corruption, and degeneracy. Again, this is decades before the internet. The good people of this great nation have been supplied with nothing but false charts. Charts which show a safe channel precisely where lie the deadliest rocks, and which pretend that the only possible safe channel is the path to destruction. Trusting and believing in these forged charts. Think about Barbara Taylor Spector, was her name, a Jew up in Europe, saying Europe is going to be destroyed unless it becomes diverse. So it's the exact opposite of the truth. And they've been doing that, of course, for many, many hundreds of years. Trusting and believing in these forged charts, the phony facts and rigged news they are given, our people have innocently driven the once great American ship of state onto just about every shoal and rock there is, producing the kind of wreckage and despair we saw in chapters 1 and 2. Our people have been taught that their real heroes and leaders are, quote, haters, bigots, and fascists, while the real haters and bigots are exalted by our phony charts, our press, as statesmen and world leaders. So he's saying the phony chart purveyors are the press. Back then, you'll notice they didn't use the term narrative like we do today. Well, I don't use it. I really, really dislike narrative. It just means lie. We have been forced under the rocks of communism and degeneracy by the press, TV, books, etc., which have praised every kind of rottenness and filth as, quote, love, brotherhood, etc., thus ensuring that our people will sail unsuspectingly down the channel onto the rocks. And even when they keep piling up on the rocks, the people still do not suspect that anybody has palmed off forged charts on them. Rather, they naively believe that they simply didn't try hard enough, so that next time they smash up even harder. Again, what's the media context where he's talking? It's where you've got two or three main papers, the New York Times, Washington Post, both Jew-owned, and the rest of the press of the nation takes their bearing from these leaders and repeats what they say in a lesser key. And then you've got three television stations and seven movie studios. We're just starting to come out of that period into the period of cable TV starting to spread, but still then, media control is very consolidated, and it's all completely Jewish, as I'm sure he'll get into. When integration, for instance, produces some of the horrors shown in Chapter 1, our poor, swindled people are taught to believe it is because we need more integration. While the liars and forgers are driving our unwitting people up the rock-studded fake channels, they are also removing the lighthouses and buoys which once guided mankind into safe and quiet harbors in the storms. They have ripped up the lighthouses of religion, family, old-fashioned disciplined education, moral standards, authoritarian fathers and teachers, loving and motherly women, and that precious love of home and country called patriotism, without which a people loses its bearings, as have ours. The chart forgers have been so successful in driving our people onto the rocks, time after time, over a period of 40 years, that millions have just given up, thrown away all charts, abandoned any effort to steer at all, and are just drifting. Others, more aggressive but equally frustrated, grow beards, wear filthy clothes, mount motorcycles, and race around attacking almost anything in sight. And he wasn't, but he might have been speaking, if he were alive today, about the Antifa. They just busted about five of them, and they were mostly white, down in Atlanta, and they were trying to, I don't know, burn someone to death in a car and attack the police for some ridiculous... These are people who are completely misguided. They've been lied to their entire lives, and they're angry and frustrated, but they aren't able to correctly locate the problem hence bring about the right solution in their own behavior and actions, let alone for anything broader. And so they're attracted to garbage like Antifa, which is just communism, Jewish communism, Jewish program for deracinated whites. And they blow their lives, and they make society worse. So he's talking about an early version of that there. Back then it was, you know, with beatniks, and then it was hippies, and then it was just people essentially liberated from all standards and finding that doesn't really work very well for your private life. Still others, the quote liberals, have made a cult of shipwreck. They have seen their own lives ruined under the impossible spiritual and intellectual frustrations of the liberal lies of the chart forgers. They haven't got the guts to face the facts of their own mistakes, and so they have convinced themselves that no matter how many rocks they hit sailing by the false charts, their charts and lies are right and true, and the fault lies in extremists, haters, and fascists who are secretly putting rocks in the channel. Confirmed and rotten old whores and drunkards get a certain relief from their conscience pangs by seducing young innocents into their own rotten ways of life. And in the same way, the liberal victims of the chart forgers who have their own lives spoiled and shipwrecked by the lies of the chart forgers get a depraved satisfaction out of seducing other young innocents by spreading the same lies and fake charts which wreck their own miserable lives and are wrecking the lives of our young people. The chart forgers and their liberal army of victims, he always puts liberal in quotations, the chart forgers and their liberal army of victims begin their attack on the minds of our people when the child is still in kindergarten. Suddenly, the tots are infused with unconscious doubts about the wisdom and methods of their own fathers and mothers. The tiny minds are led to believe that any discipline and order imposed at home is old-fashioned and, quote, tyranny, although the kids never hear such words. Imagine what he would say about today when they're fed sexual stuff and tranny stuff. On through the grades, the process of misleading our new citizens proceeds. American heroes, Washington, Patrick Henry, etc., were not real heroes at all, but greedy little men out for gain or glory. The Constitution is outdated. Religion is opium. Morals are square. I didn't notice this subtle forging and distortion of our national heritage and degrading of our heroes and traditions imposed on me at first. It was not until I was a young undergraduate of Brown University in 1938 that I finally made direct contact with these chart forgers, whose identification and overthrow would later become my life work. But I didn't know about or even suspect them. Now, his family is kind of from the Midwest and the Northeast, but then he went to Brown, which is more in the Northeast or Pennsylvania, and then he went out west and was in the Navy, and the Navy has a lot of out of San Diego area. And he began to really study conservatism. So this is his process. So he has a pretty good understanding of the world and the USA from having lived and moved around all over it. And from his parents who were actors and would have been, you know, here and there. Acting is naturally very promiscuous, not even necessarily sexual, although usually that too, but it's spreading around, adopting different characters. All of this stuff is not really, it's more or less the opposite of stability, the opposite of something considered honorable. Actors were always basically considered prostitutes. Part of that is because they're not keeping a stable character. It's okay, it's fun and entertaining, but it's not really something that the respectable people respect, even if they're paying to be amused by it, you see. So this is the background he comes out of. You're having a right-wing person, but with not like so much of a purely business or accounting sort of background, nothing staid, but very flexible and speaking and acting and being extroverted and talking to people. So these people, when they're found in the right, are very valuable. Right-wing people tend to be, I wouldn't say necessarily introverted, because introverts are always going to be a minority, but they tend to be more prickly and more loners. The ones who are at the top intellectually, that's much more common. The ones who are extroverted, like Byron Jost, the late filmmaker, made the line in the sand and what was it, Minority Report or Partly Done, was one of these friendly, outgoing type people, which are unusual in the right. But Rockwell was that same way, but he was also much larger physical military presence. So he combined a lot of the things you need to be an effective leader. And who knows what he might have done if he had not been assassinated in 67. It was not until I was a young undergraduate of Brown University, and again, this is an Ivy League school, in 1938, undergrad 38 Brown, that I finally made direct contact with these chart forgers, whose identification and overthrow would become my life work. But I didn't know or even suspect them then. I don't remember even thinking about such a thing any more than I did Thuggyism in India. Thuggy was an actual religion in India. That's where the word thug comes from. And they would waylay people on the road. They were like highwaymen back in old India and beat them up and poison them and steal their stuff. Thugs comes from Thuggyism, which is, I guess, made into a actual sort of religion. So it's sort of like Judaism being an inherently criminal religion. I was still blissful. It'd be interesting to actually study that and try to find some parallels. I don't know that Thuggy, how that relates to any kind of genes or anything. I think the British, when they went in there, the Raj stomped it out, killed it off. I was still blissfully and totally ignorant of communism, Jews, Negroes. He's saying he didn't know any more about Jews than he did about thug or Thuggyism. Blissfully and totally ignorant of communism, Jews, Negroes, and the assault of the colored masses of the world against the white race and its elite. In a way, I am glad of this long-maintained ignorance, because today, when I meet young college men and women who are full of conceit because of their, quote, liberalism and, quote, understanding of our social problems, I can be patient with them. I can imagine my own reaction if I had been told as a college boy that there was a Jewish or any other kind of world conspiracy. I was sure at that time that my deep, quote-unquote, studies into the profundities of knowledge would have long ago revealed any such monstrous conspiracy, and even if not, that my professors and men of learning would surely have known it. I would have been angry at such effrontery, just as much most young college kids I meet today are, at first, angry because they've only heard one side. Yeah, they're not even aware there is another side. That's the failure is less, it's not people being dumb. They don't have imagination. So when they hear something, they take it at face value. Everyone else seems to believe it. They would have no reason to doubt it. But they never realize, particularly with women and feminism, they never realize they're being fed something that is not only wrong, they don't even realize there's another way to look at it. They don't, because they don't think and they don't read. The vast majority of women do not, or arguably are not capable of thinking very much. And most men are like most women. That's the part they always leave out. They, oh, you're anti-woman or anti-misogynist, but they never point out. And I say the same thing. Most men are, 90% of men are like women mentally. They are less up and down. They're a little more logical, but ultimately they're not really very different. They're taking impressions and repeating what they hear from things they recognize as authority because others recognize them as authority, not because they internally value it and say, well, this person has authority because I've read what he says and I've evaluated it and I believe it's likely true. And if it's not, then I'll know how to find that out too, because there's something objective. Not too many are capable of that. So he's saying these college kids are angry. They've only heard one side and they don't realize it. In 1939, I sat in Sociology 1 class at Brown University and tried my best to make some sense out of it all. I'd been happy at the chance to study sociology, and I've said before, a professor I knew, his name was Fred Lynch, who wrote Invisible Victims and the Crisis of Affirmative Action, said sociology is basically 100% Marxist. He was the one who was not. He loves sociology, but he said it's 100% Marxist. He told me that personally. So this is back in 1939, and it probably goes all the way back to Comte, they would say, a French guy back around 1800. But even before, let's say, anthropology was totally Jewed and converted from physical facts, bones, evidence, into something soft, weak, mushy, and using science as advertising rather than reality, Jews affected that transformation via Franz Boas, as we know, for MacDonald or others. Same probably with sociology even earlier. In 1939, I sat in Sociology 1 class at Brown, tried to make sense of it. I'd been happy at the chance to study sociology, as it appeared to me logical that there must be some fundamental principles of the development of the social relationships of life, as I had discovered simple basic principles of the affairs of other affairs I had looked into. So, okay, if I take sociology, I can learn what are the basic ways that people relate to others in a group. Because sociology is a bias, essentially, that people are affected by the groups rather than being individuals. Now, that's obviously, a lot of that is true, but it's not all true. But sociology is going to tend to see men as a function of their setting or their circumstances rather than the thing creating the circumstances, right? But a little of each is true. It's not either or. You're not an individual purely, and you're not a collective purely. You're some mixture of both, each appropriate to the context and the decision, the concept of subsidiarity. I don't know where it comes from, but Catholics are big in it, but it happens to be correct, which is a thing needs to be handled at the right level. Brushing your teeth is an individual duty. It's not a collective duty. Whereas, like garbage collection, that might be something that is better. What level is that better handled? The national level? Should we have a national garbage collection? Well, that doesn't really seem to make sense. Maybe something that's like handled more at the city level. If there's stuff that's really poisonous that we can't really have floating around, well, then maybe we need to have like a group collective decision about it at some level, state, city, neighborhood. You understand? That's the concept of subsidiarity is a beautiful concept, honestly, and something you always want to be thinking about. I had a coworker, he once said to me something interesting. He said, the lawyer is very socially effective person, very quiet spoken. His father had actually been big into like drugs and drinking and led a totally clamorous life. And he, having learned from this person, led an extremely regular life, got married to a really nice woman. Last I knew, he was actually from the Northeast. He single-handedly changed my view of the Northeast. So I'd always been somewhat biased against it because no one in my family liked Kennedys. And they just saw those people want to make decisions for you and run your life and obnoxious. And while I still believe that, it is generally is true, there's still nothing wrong with people from up there. But anyway, this fellow led a very regular, good life, and someone I work with and really got to like. But he had said that he was, one of his concerns, he just mentioned this kind of offhand, was he was trying to figure out exactly the right level. And this is a parallel concept to subsidiarity of how much should I tell this person that they can deal with? And I thought, it's someone totally different from me. I've always tried to be, a lot of people are either a Bill Clinton type where they completely compartmentalize everything. There's going to be a lot of things we're not telling Miss Clinton. A lot of people are like that. And I think that comes to them naturally, and it's obviously very effective. Then there's people like my type who are like, I want someone looking at me from three-quarter behind, fully behind, on the side, in front of me. I think they're going to see the same thing. And I always thought that's a sign that when everyone who looks at you sees the same thing, that your beliefs line up with your behavior and you have integrity. That's how I look at it. But there are more sophisticated, subtle, sly, and even probably effective ways of being, since the people like Clinton rise to the top. But maybe for what I'm doing, my way is the best. I don't know. But this person told me this also plays into the Nazi view of propaganda. You got to reach, you have to design it no more complex than to reach the lowest person you're trying to reach. You got to take the dumbest guy that you want to reach, not literal retards, because they're going to be in an institution, right? The ones we see walking around in public, I've made this point many times, are the ones who are able to keep it between the navigational beakers, as Jimmy Buffett said in that one song he did with the other country guy, which given how feeble and fat a lot of these are is amazing. But you got to remember, there's another 10% that are warehoused effectively, some kind of warehouse or other, some human warehouse, not just for the old age, but for the mentally incapable. So my point is, there's an element of that in what my friend and coworker was saying, like how to, is it how much to give the person or what form you put it in? I think the Nazis would agree with me. You could say anything to anyone, from a five-year-old to a PhD, is how I usually style it. If you choose the right language, bad guys, good guys for a five-year-old. And you can't make it a hell of a lot more complex than that if you're trying to reach the lowest level person, right? So what can the person handle? And learning to talk to them. And again, this is not so much really between compartmentalizing versus, I hate the word transparent, but I'll use that right now for what I described as my own position. I don't like transparency because stuff goes on is my business. It's not anyone else's, and I'm not going to tell them about it because they want to know. You don't need to be see-through, but you do need to have integrity is how I look at it. And Aryans have always allowed that people have, you have to give them their privacy and their dignity. Their privacy is part of their dignity, and you have to, you know, give them maybe an extra 10% to assume they're going to be upright. But when beyond 10%, then you're becoming a fool. But less than 10%, then society has fallen apart into a bunch of snarling dogs. You see what I'm saying? And that's what society means. It's kind of about that extra, try to give a little 10% more than you get, right? If everybody does that, you know, all of a sudden things work pretty well, right? We don't need to have saints and martyrs and all this garbage. We just need to be, you know, give a little more than you get, and things are going to tend to be working well. After all, you're one of nature's chosen. You get to look there with your one nose, your two eyes. You got it going on, buddy. I picked that up from Call Me Chris. She always starts her videos by sucking up to her audience with compliments. Isn't that funny? But she's doing video, of course. Her having a really extraordinarily beautiful face doesn't hurt. And she's very expressive, and she does all of her little characters, and that's all it takes. So real art doesn't require a whole lot of costumes and writing and whatever. It requires an actual ability. That's a side point, though. I've linked to her videos in a couple of feeds on Kirk's Tool today. Anyway, so how much to give people? Is it a matter of how much to give them and not just start pouring? I knew another woman. She would talk to me, and she would. I'm like, you can't do that. You're fire hosing me with stuff that I don't need to know, and I can't do anything about. You got to. And she claimed that she was, this was many years ago, she claimed that she was, I don't know, bipolar or whatever, one of these fancy con. I'm like, you got to control you cannot deal with these women in any weak way. You just say, look, you got to control yourself, okay? You got to, don't talk to me like you're fire hose hitting me. And that also relates to what my coworker is saying, like, how much do I give you, this other person, how much can you handle? What's the right way to put it? Is it more how much? I almost think it's how much and almost the speed. It's very, very difficult in this world to be considerably smarter than average if you're not operating day to day in an environment of people of equally high IQ. And I kid you not, I only had this happen once, because once I left college, I've only been around people of average intelligence ever since. And that's why I'm more or less a loner. But you go back to that environment, it really is like coming out of the sea on the land. You don't even realize what is that effect, Dunning-Kruger or some other? You literally, as much as you would think me making fun of all these people, they're actually dumber than you think. And the truth is, almost the best thing you can do in life is just keep your fucking mouth shut. 99% of the time, that's your best strategy. And I say that as someone who loves to talk, for good or bad. I enjoy it probably even more than most women. And that's what I'm doing. You know, I do this independently. You can't strike back at me. I can talk and I can give ideas. Maybe they're useful to some, maybe they're not. But it allows me to think about these things out loud. And this is more or less what's going on in my head all the time. I'm thinking about these different things. I'm trying to do like what Hitler said about reading. You know, I add a little piece more from this person on the outside. It doesn't have to be from books or magazines or anything, and you add it in, and you build up this mosaic, this picture of what's going on. And every little new thing that you get, whether it's from a book, this is how you make reading useful, either clarifies or contradicts what you already know. And if it contradicts, you got to get that figured out. But if it clarifies, all of a sudden you're getting a bigger and bigger and bigger and better and finer and more, it pulls more detailed and more expansive picture of what's going on in the world actually. and how that's particularly important in an age when everything in the controlled media is a lie, right? So what do we say to others? How do we say it? There's a real art and skill in this. And my point is, even people who are very different from me come to different conclusions, and you can judge by their actions. Now, the one book I read, I'm not big into reading about political figures, biographies and all that, but I've told you before, I read a book about Bill Clinton, and the guy said he was so skilled, he could basically talk to two people at the same time who were on different sides of a problem and come away with both of them thinking he was on their side. Now, that is the ultimate, whatever you want to call it, sophistry or democratic ability, an extremely refined ability to lie, coupled with very high IQ, very high energy. Clinton was very, very energetic, and complete amorality. So he might do the right thing now and then, but it certainly would only be because it benefited him. Like when they talked about, you know, super predators and such. Anyway, that little discursus, back to it. In 1939, I sat in Sociology 1 class at Brown University and tried my best to make some sense out of it all. I'd been happy at the chance to study sociology, as it appeared to me logical that there must be some fundamental principles of the development of the social relationships of life, as I had discovered simple basic principles of other affairs I had looked into. And I'm not done talking. So someone thankfully sent me, since I was, quote, gently removed, unquote, from my alumni magazine from Pomona College. Well, now they've now got the NOG percentage, I don't know, up to 40-50% of wise Latinas and angry slant-eyed Asians and even a lot of blacks. So they now want to exclude their, and see, Pomona is a small school. I think it's still 400 people or so, undergraduate. And to the extent they have activism, they are on a 5-college campus. So there's others around. It's a little bit larger, but it's still tiny compared to like Berkeley. So they take their leftist bearing from Berkeley and do a kind of Me Too of the real big leftist centers like Berkeley up the coast from where Pomona is. Pomona's inland. It's not on the coast. Anyway, this is a follow on. So they have just the way they had at Berkeley, where like they're trying to exclude whites from certain areas, even though legally they can't do it. They're de facto doing it. And the deans, who are always the most obnoxious and aggressive on this stuff, are backing them up. And so at Pomona, so you can't quite get the dean, because one of the college reform, one of these neocon ones that is anti-liberal on the stuff that doesn't matter, i.e. except on race, calls the dean up. Oh, well, she, of course, will confirm that whites aren't allowed in there, but whether they would feel uncomfortable being there, you know, you see how it goes. Anyway, a couple of years ago, these same people were at Pomona, which is the only reason I mention it, were specifically denouncing objective truth as a white male construct. So that's where you end up. When you drop standards to admit coloreds, eventually the coloreds you let in will destroy all standards, not just for their own admission, but they'll destroy the very reason the university exists in the first place. If there's no objective truth to be discovered, you sure as hell don't need a university. If truth is whatever you want, then why learn anything? But it just as this is absurd in something small, like there's a right way to repair a broken taillight, and there's no wrong way. There's just either the right way or it doesn't work, right? Well, that's a small thing. And on the larger things, it's there as well. Anyway, enough. Now, forward. In 1939, I sat in Sociology 1 class at Brown and tried to make sense. There must be some fundamental principles of the development of the social relationships of life. That's what now sociology all about, our relations to others and how the influence of collectives. As I had discovered simple basic principles of other affairs I had looked into, I was most eager to learn these basic principles of the operation of human society so that I could understand the events around me, and perhaps even predict sociological occurrences in accordance with the principles I would be taught. I have since learned that there are such principles, as will be shown later. And again, that's the proof of any theory, is it can predict things. What most people do, what average people do, what you, even if you are an average person, do not want to do, is show up after the fact and say, I knew it. Everybody knows everything after the fact. It takes no courage to do that. It's a common vice. It's a common vice to show up after and say, I knew he was crazy from his eyes. No. If you have something that's actually valid, it will be able to predict things. Call them ahead of time, not after the fact. But it would be many, many years before I would fight my way to the simple, fundamental, and logical facts of social life. In Professor Buckland's classroom on society at Brown University, all was the most depressing darkness and confusion. It sounded most enlightening, of course. There were lots of brave new words, quote, ethnic groups, etc. But try as I might, I could not get to the bottom of it all to find any idea, nor could I get a hold of any principle. Muddiness of mind was not deplored, but glorified. I buried myself in my sociology books, absolutely determined to find why I was missing the kernel of the thing. The best I could come up with in sociology was that human beings are all helpless tools of environment. He's a product of his environment. Well, in a sense, yes, but the environment is a product of you. Remember Family Guy, maybe the Noid should have looked out for me. As Mayor Adam West says that, maybe the Noid should have avoided me from the old pizza commercial. And, you know, a note on production values. I tape, I don't edit. Now, when I do Team White with Jan, yes, we edit, but, or he edits. He edits and produces it. I do not. Just as we did with Aegis back in the old days of Crossfire. I simply record, and if the recording's bad, I record over again. But I don't break it up at all. So I'm fairly careful that when I do record or if I take long periods off, there's a good reason. I'm not healthy or I'm not in good nose, as I like to put it. My nose is not clear. I don't want to sound all verklempt, physically verklempt, not emotionally verklempt. I'm not really emotionally verklempt. And I'm fully ready to go when I record. And sometimes it comes and goes. You never know. So if I say something, I can tell you what I'm going to do generally, but I cannot tell you generally when I'm going to do it. It just happens sometimes. I didn't think I was going to start recording again until the end of January, but I felt like just right one day, so I did it. I feel pretty good, pretty darn good today, and it's the shortest day of the year. It's also winter solstice. Let's stick that in here. Solstice 3:47 on 2022 CST. Solstice is the shortest day of the year. Equinox, you have equal light, north and south. This is like the point when the sun is, I think, at the farthest north. Or it could be south. Farthest north or south is what solstice means. Anyway, I was just looking that up earlier. But anyway, so yeah, sociology is going to have the inherent bias, which doesn't mean that everything it comes up with is wrong, that humans are a product of groups or circumstances, helpless tools of environment, he says, that we are all born as rigidly equal lumps. That's the John Rawls, quote, original position, if you've ever read his awful philosophy. And the disparity of our achievements and stations was entirely and 100% the result of forces of environment that everybody, therefore, could theoretically be master geniuses and kings if only we could sufficiently improve everybody's environment. Yeah, that's the basic bias of sociology, because it provides an excuse then for why blacks have failed and whites have succeeded. I was bold enough to ask Professor Buckland if this were the idea. He turned red with anger. I was told it was impossible to make any generalizations, although all I was asking for is the fundamental idea, if any, of sociology. I began to see that sociology was different from any other course I had ever taken. Certain ideas produced apoplexy in the teacher, particularly the suggestion that perhaps some people were no good biological slobs from the day they were born. Certain other ideas, although they were never, never formulated and stated frankly, were fostered and encouraged. And these were always ideas revolving around the total power of environment. slowly I got the idea. At first, I just used it to get better grades. When I wrote my essay answers and examinations, I poured it on heavily that all hands in the civilization in question were potential Leonardo da Vinci's, no matter how black they were or how they ate their best friends for thousands of years, and that with a quick change in environment, these cannibals, too, would be writing arias, building Parthenons, and painting masterpieces. But then I began to wonder, how come? Certainly environment was important. Anybody could see that. But it was obviously negative. You could make a helpless boob out of a born genius by raising him locked in a dark closet. But you can't make a genius out of a drooling idiot, even by sending him to Brown. Was it just old man Buckland who was insane with environment, or was it the whole subject? So this guy was actually going to college to learn. He made it a learning college by his own desire to learn. I went to the library and read more sociology books. Again, well before internet, this was his only option. They were universally pushing the same idea. I began to make fun of sociology in the college paper in my column and got into more trouble. Some of the columns were killed before seeing the light. Again, my own personal exact experience in the 80s in Pomona. I was still too ignorant to know that I was fighting Lysenko and Marx and the whole Soviet theory of environmentalism. Yeah, Lysenko is the identical with bogus science, which has captured and hypnotized and terrorized all our intellectuals. I imagine I was battling just one foolish college course. Again, like my own realization about Jews was not so much that they were prominent, it was 100,000 times deeper than I had realized as I learned from The Ordeal of Civility, which of course we made a book out of, which you can find at viennainforum.com, The Ordeal of Civility by John Murray Cudahy. During my second year at Brown, my picture of the world darkened as I discovered more and more the intellectual dishonesty in the university, which had at first seemed almost heaven itself to me. Again, wasn't he, I think, coming from Bloomington, Illinois? So he's going back east to the big smart school, and unlike others, he's not falling for what he hears like so many of these Cal State rubes who go to the big city and get magic by the Jews, feeding them lies. But I could not avoid the steady pressure everywhere in the university to accept the idea of massive human equality and the supremacy of environment. In every course, I was repulsed by the intellectual cowardice of the faculty in standing up for any doctrine whatsoever. I majored in philosophy, and while I admired the intellectual brilliance of my professors, particularly Professor Ducasse, D-U-C-A-S-S-E, I was hugely disappointed in the headlong retreat of all the faculty whenever they were asked their own opinion as to the objective truth in any matter. I was told that eternal seeking is the way to knowledge, and there is no denying that. But lively discussion is also vital to any advance, and you cannot have any lively discussion where the opposition either doesn't exist or melts away like a wraith. A wraith is like a ghost when you seek to take hold of it. Move on to page 27. I was running into the social disease of our modern life, cowardice, and pathological fear of a strong personality or strong ideas. Dale Carnegie has codified and commercialized this creeping disease as, quote, how to win friends and influence people, which boils down in essence to the principle of having no personality or strong feelings or ideas and becoming passive and empty so that the other fellow can display his ideas and personality. Now, that's exactly right, and this is one of the biggest, most popular self-help psychology books of the mid-century, How to Win Friends and Influence People. And essentially, don't say anything, just ask them about, and it's not even bad. It's like Christianity. It's like a half bad that is all the worse for being half of it being right. Christianity being the stuff about sex and family. In self-help, it would be like actually take an interest in other people and listen to them. That gets you beyond egotism. But along with that, you're basically never supposed to, you're not supposed to essentially it's advertising democracy for at the personal level. Just, you know, smile and be friendly and never tell people what they don't want to hear. Don't be cutting. Don't have any real personality or strong opinion or principles. You see? I think that's a pretty good parallel. I never thought of it before. I think it's a decent parallel, though. You can see how the Jews would find that useful, because make yourself into a vessel for the strong ideas coming from the top. Now, they sure as hell don't believe that themselves. They accuse anyone who disagrees with them as being a hater. Other people are defined by their attitude toward Jews rather than having any independent existence of their own. They're just stupid anti-Semites. We need to get large grants to protect ourselves from, even though we are the ones aggressing against them. Back to the text, but he too is trying to get, quote, popular by being passive and dispassionate, so that the result is like two dead batteries, no current. Such human robots are suited to enslavement by a 1984 type society, but not to a bold, free society of men. I found the same wishy-washy. He's basically saying none of these people, you know, it's supposed to be a college and truth and beliefs, and I'm finding none of it. None of the professors will take any kind of a stance on anything. I found the same wishy-washy approach in every subject except in the sciences, and for these last, I was very grateful. Here, in geology and psychology, I could find a few principles and laws which stayed there when I reached out to grasp them, something solid. And so I reveled in these subjects and rebelled to the limit of my capacity in the others. Finally, the hardness, the solidity, the strength he seeks, he finds in geology and psychology, which is surprising. The psychology is surprising to me. In sociology, I went so far as to write an insolent examination paper, which almost got me thrown out of Brown. We were asked to write an essay on the factors leading to criminality and delinquency. I wrote a fable about a crew of scientific geniuses who set out for Africa to see what made ants act like ants, searched around until they found a lot of anthills, observed them for many years, and finally came up with the discovery that when eggs were hatched in tunnels in a certain kind of hill in Africa and grew up among six-legged creatures called ants, they themselves were so affected by this strong environment that they became themselves ants and waved their antennae like ants, scurried around like ants, looked like ants, and were ants. I was hauled up before the administration for this impudence and almost thrown out. Instead, I was given another opportunity to write the same exam. And for the sake of my dear good grandmother and my patient loving Aunt Margie, I sat down and wrote what I knew they wanted, a piece showing how unfortunate and most excellent Negro babies were invariably driven to stealing from their parents, relatives, and friends, robbing strangers at the point of a gun, looting, and finally axing somebody in sheer desperation at their nasty environment. Yeah. I know what he means. They probably put up the money for his education. He is, all right, I'll just get out of here and never deal with these nabobs again. Nattering nabobs of nescience. Meanwhile, I was learning mightily from my endless bull sessions with Vic Hillary and Bob Grab, two bees, my constant companions. Both of them were soused to the ears with the prevailing, quote, liberalism, although I still did not know what it was. I simply discovered that almost all my ideas clashed violently with theirs. My ideas that socially significant novels were dangerous because they allowed ideas to sneak into the mind while it was still hypnotized by an illusion of reality was especially aggravating to them both, as we all aspire to creative careers, they as novelists and writers. My attack on the very social novels they were aiming to write was painful, and their reactions, particularly Hillary's, were most passionate. Far into the night, we would battle over this matter with the usual results, no progress. But in the process, I learned the art of controversy. At first, I was too sincere and naive to do anything but try to make my opponent see the truth of my position with the utmost force and honesty. But then I found that I would fall victim of the dirtiest kind of sly tricks. My position would be enormously and ridiculously exaggerated, caricatured, and then it would be flung in my face in triumph to the great laughter of the audience of listeners or participants. I could not understand when even my beloved and revered friends did this to me. I was more than once too hurt by such liberal tactics to defend myself. But, as with everything else in my life, when I discovered the inevitability of such illogical skullduggery, I schooled myself in it and one day turned the tables on my liberal friends. More and more at Brown, I came into basic conflict with the prevailing super-liberalism, still without ever realizing what it was all about. My companions, my courses, my professors, and the latest erudite books, everything seemed to me to be touched with madness. I fought it fiercely and, for my ignorance, powerfully, but mostly by instinct. He knew it was wrong, but he didn't have the pure knowledge to know why or the specific citations and sources and ideas, exactly articulated ideas. I simply had never heard of communism as anything but a doctrine held by a few fanatics someplace overseas. That the campus dorms, fraternity houses, and classrooms of Brown University were crawling with the filthy thing, I would never have believed. I would have laughed to scorn anybody who had tried to tell me such a fantastic thing then. So again, he's still stuck in the political level, and even there he doesn't see how extensive it is. Since this environmental, quote, equality idea of liberals is literally insane, a delusion substituted for reality. Since men are also creatures who differ by breed just as much as dogs, horses, birds, or any other living creatures. Since some breeds of men are brighter than others and some are infinitely stupider than others, it is inevitable that the attempt to organize any useful body of organized facts about human behavior, starting from the insane premise that they are all hereditarily equal, must wind up full of obvious contradictions and insanities. And this is exactly what happens. If you try to argue with the guy in the nut house who thinks he is Napoleon, he will not only prove it to you, but he will hate you for doubting his, quote, sacred, holy truth and believe you are out to get him. But if he tries to write his proofs that he is Napoleon into a learned scientific paper, if he is a lucid type nut, he will see that his proofs don't look too well in writing, and so he will resort to gobbledygook, writing of profound phrases and $64 words to becloud, what would be obviously insane if it were clear. One must becloud what would be obviously insane if it were clear. So anytime someone is not writing clearly or speaking clearly, it is either because they are incapable of it or because clarity would make it clear that they're wrong or insane. That's precisely what I found going on in sociology, only I didn't know it then. I didn't know what was wrong. I only knew that there was no way to get my feet on the ground in sociology, no way to come to grips with one single sure fact. Everything was, quote, by and large, on the one hand, but then on the other hand, Blattner and Fink say so-so, but then Fiddler and Fudd say it's the other way around, et cetera, ad nauseum. I had stumbled head-on into one of the fundamental symptoms of our times, a very literal insanity, a desperate, frantic, pitiful effort by men who pretend to be the most enlightened of all humanity to cling to the delusion that the only difference between Shakespeare and a savage is environment. And if we only manage to improve the environment enough, every cannibal can be a Chopin, every pygmy a Lord Nelson, every Bantu a Beethoven, and even East Indian ragamuffin a Voltaire. History, biology, political science, economies, every organized body of knowledge must be twisted and wrenched to any extreme to maintain this insane and obvious delusion. The way those afflicted with this modern insanity cover up their madness from others, and mostly from themselves, is this process of pious, scientific muddying of everything about the, quote, sacred doctrine. It is for this reason we are forever told things are always, quote, gray in this world, that there are no simple solutions, that there are, quote, no black and whites. The fact that many things do exist as shades of gray rather than black and white does not mean that there is no such thing as black and white. Yet that is what the modern madmen of equality keep trying to put out, precisely because they don't want any ordinary guy with common horse sense pointing out that they are full of beans. Put simply, the equality theories of these witch doctors of, quote, modern science would be laughed out of countenance by any schoolboy if they were put in plain black and white, simple language. They are idiotic and dishonest on their face. But in pages of witch doctor gobbledygook, they intimidate and impress many of our supposedly higher trained minds and produce, quote, liberal fanatics. Sociology was an endless sea of gray mud. The only thing I could get out clearly was that environment was everything, while heredity was a myth concocted by Southern brutes trying to re-enslave the Negroes. By nature, I am a rebel, so I rebelled at this insanity. I wasn't sure what it was or why they were doing it, but I did know for sure that it was crazy. While at Brown, I never did learn why the obviously intelligent and learned men all around me at the college were so all-fired, hung up on what seemed to me to be such obvious madness. Now, more than 20 years and 3 wars later, I know what was going on and why. I was surrounded by the most basic of all the lies of the chart forgers, the lie denying race. Denying that there is any such thing as breed, race and breed in all caps, among men. Denying race, denying breed among men, as there is breed among all other species. And you know what? I'm going to leave it right there. We've been going almost an hour, and I want to just keep all that fresh in your mind. I think that's plenty enough for you to think about today. What kind of man you are, what world you live in, what effect the environment has on you, and what effect you have on the environment. And I'd like to think that you stand out from the environment well, and perhaps you're even capable of picking up a pebble here and placing it over there where it's better suited to advance your life interest in our society, our mutual society. Anyway, thank you for being with me. I've been Alex Linder, reading to you out of George Lincoln Rockwell's White Power, Chapter 3. We've done the first, I don't know, 7-8 pages. Chapter 3, The Chart Forgers. And I'll be back with you again real soon, and we'll pick up where we left off. Good day.